Welcome back to On Call Nightmares. My name is Jay. Once again, we have another episode where I interview another member of the tech industry, and this time I'm going to introduce you to Jamisha Fisher. Jamisha is an expert in security as well as operations, and really gives us an incredible look into their career and things that they've done, which has been kind of a prolific career, almost 15 years. But other than that, let's just talk a little bit about what's going on. And right now, it is the day before DevOps Days, New York City 2019. I'm really excited to help get started on another big year of talking about what's going on in DevOps, hearing talks from people from all over that have come to New York City to kind of let us know what's been going on in their world. I'm going to be doing a quick Ignite talk on checklists, something that I think when you're building out an on-call process is extremely important. So we're going to get started with the podcast. We'll introduce you to Jam, and then we'll close up with announcements for this week. Remember, if you'd like to contribute to the podcast, you can just email me. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with us on Twitter. It's @oncallnightmare, or you can just reach out to me on Twitter @jdestro. So let's hear what Jam has to say, all right? We'll be right back. Welcome back to the On Call Nightmares podcast. This is Jay. So one of the things that I want to make sure that I'm doing in this podcast is getting to speak with people that not only are doing interesting things in On Call, but I just think are interesting people in general. So that leads me to introducing you to someone that I met at a conference a few years back, and I'll be honest, I feel like I'm really lucky I got a chance to. So Jam Fisher is an infrastructure engineer at Splice. Jam has worked in the tech industry for over 15 years with a special interest in security, graduating with a degree in information assurance and security engineering. They lent their experience to operations and systems engineering at companies like Google and GitHub. In their spare time, Jam queers it up, along with being a maker of things, musical or delicious, and objects that use binary numbers. Jam, thank you so much for being part of this podcast today.
Thank you. Also, I'm just going to add, if people don't know me by Jam, my full name is Jamisha Fisher, or Jamfish728 on the Twitters. So awesome. If people are unfamiliar with what people call me.
Sure.
But yeah, happy to be here.
Thanks. So let's get kind of started with who you are, but I want to give everybody a quick brief on how I met you. So I believe it was a DevOps Days in San Jose, I think, maybe in the Bay Area.
Yeah, it was when it had to be either DevOps Days 2015 or 2016. Mm-hmm. I forget, but I was an organizer at the time. And so I think I was one of the people to just kind of be behind the scenes. And so mm-hmm. I started talking to you that way.
Yes. Well, very lucky that you did, because came to learn a little bit about yourself, your interest in security, in reliability, and the things that kind of come with working at pretty big places like Google and GitHub, and obviously what you're doing now at Splice. So
yeah.
I know you've moved from the Bay Area out towards the Midwest in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
How's the cold been changing you so far this year? It's pretty rough here.
Like, it's honestly, surprisingly, it is not that bad.
Okay.
Like, it's actually, I've kind of been disappointed because it hasn't been snowing that much. Mm-hmm. But it did finally like drop below zero here. So I'm like, yes.
Gotcha.
And so now I'm truly learning the phrase that they have in Minnesota. It's like, there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothes. live by that. Had several layers on when it got below zero. Was very, very happy. But I've also lived in the Midwest before though. So like, not my first time to the rodeo.
Gotcha. So tell me a little bit about your history in this world of technology. You did some stuff with Google and GitHub. You want to kind of tell us how you got there?
Yeah. So basically, I started in technology when I was probably about 13, but I didn't get my first internship until I was 15. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I got into Google is that eventually I went to school and I became pretty much the on-campus IT tech person for mm-hmm. pretty much labs for an entire campus. So basically I was the person to come and fix the lab machines pretty much all over Lincoln Park at DePaul University. So at that point, I kept on going back home for the summers, and the summer before last, I ended up doing temporary jobs, and I got a really, really bad one, and after that, and after going through that experience, which I'm always grateful for, because that showed me, like, mm-hmm. my hustle, and it also showed me that, like, you know, I want to do what I want to do, but also kind of being grateful that there are people doing that work as well. But going back to my story, like, it was near my junior year, and I was like, okay, I need to obviously get an internship under my belt. So I applied to a whole lot of companies in December. One of them was Google. I did not hear back from them. And this was like winter of 2007. Did not hear back from them until March 2008, and I nearly didn't believe it, because it was after a cyber defense competition that I went to. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed, got the job there, and so did a summer internship with them, made many contacts, and then ended up going through my senior year and graduating, getting my first job as a junior system administrator for the first time, and this is going to be important later. Mm-hmm. And then found out that Google was having a program under the department that I interned in called the Internal Technology Residency Program. And so 2-year program, working in IT as well as rotating into other groups during the 2 years. Also, sorry, that's my cat. if you can,
it's quite all right. We normally have a pug on this podcast, but today he's in the other room.
Yeah. The program I applied for and got in, and I was actually a part of the very, very first class of this program.
That's awesome.
So it was a good experience for me, but it also kind of opened up my doors of working in the Bay Area for pretty much nearly a decade.
That's awesome.
8 years.
Yeah, in a 15-year career, I would imagine more than half of it being out in the Bay gave you a lot of experience and a lot of opportunity. That leads me to start asking, where did on-call really become something that was part of your, like, day-to-day or regular duties?
It was the second time I became a junior system administrator, which is where I learned you never should become a junior system administrator twice.
Explain why. I'm just curious. Why should you do it twice?
Why shouldn't I do it twice? Specifically for me, pretty much I think it comes from the fact that I think I really didn't realize how much me as a Black queer person could be kind of disenfranchised until I went to the experience of working in the job where I actually had to be on call, and not believing that I was like, oh, I'm still a junior, I'm not learning anything. And my senior coworker had to be like, no, you're handling on call really well, you're handling our systems really well, and you're doing it without assistance and without help. You're not a junior. And I still couldn't believe it until he handed me a document which basically showed, okay, for system administrators, here's the levels. And I found out from that doc that I was actually mid-level. And so it was just it just kind of showed me something that I.
So it's about believing in yourself, if you would. I mean, I know it's a corny way of putting it, but
it's believing in myself and believing in my skills. And the tech industry, though I feel like it's getting better about this, you know, as I was coming up into it, it wasn't that friendly in that way.
Yeah, I mean, for people of color, it was difficult from things that people have told me in the past. For women, especially gay women or, you know, non-binary people, getting into technology was a far more difficult path because of the real constants that a homogenous kind of industry can create. And I think that can do a number on your self-confidence. I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah. And especially after, you know, after interning at Google and being like in the Midwest too, where it was just like, oh, especially graduating during a recession, having Google on my resume really helped get my foot in the door. So, you know, I'm going into the Bay Area thinking, like, oh, if I have 2 years here, obviously I'm going to leave and be able to find a job really easily. It took me months and constant searching before I found and landed something.
Gotcha.
So basically this was after, so going back to the on-call thing, sure. Pretty much this was my, this was post-Google. This was one of the startups in between Google and GitHub. And this one had to be my first one on call because this was the first job that actually required it post 8 to 5.
Okay.
The job before this I had, basically it had it between the set 8 hours I did and then I was off. It was super intense because sometimes that on-call would have stuff that's down, and that was like my first taste of it. But I really don't think I was on-call, like in the traditional sense where it's like you have to carry your laptop around.
Yeah.
And have pager duty and have it call you in the middle of the night or have it, you know, have it set up 3 phone lines of communication in case you're a heavy sleeper like I was. and so, like, this job had me working on it because it was a software as a service company.
And you were just familiar with that platform. They needed you to kind of go in and ensure that during troubling times that someone was able to get things back up and running, correct?
Yep, pretty much. Or just if a service went down, the good thing about it is that that service was probably the most well built that I've seen. Mm-hmm. So that I got a very easy understanding of it within months. And it's also the fact that I had to, because our team went down, from a team of 3, to a team of 2, like the day after I started. Yeah. So that's another reason why it's like, again, it's like the imposter syndrome kind of had to quickly wear away because I immediately went into, okay, if somebody else goes, it's only me. So you need to train me now. But that was the first job where I just really had to learn what it was like to be on rotation and handle different things and really put my troubleshooting and debugging skills and analytical skills to the test.
How long would you say you were on call consistently between more than one job too? Like if are you still on call now?
No, I am not. Okay. But I'm not in the 24/7 sense. It is going to happen soon though.
Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're starting to grow enough where it's like, okay.
So talk to me about how long you were on call for in your last stint.
In the last stint, in the 24/7 sense, it was probably 2 years and some change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so in those 2 years, I'm sure that you had something that you felt really was a moment that kind of highlighted your time in that career, in that portion of your career. And that gets me into the part of the podcast where I talk about the rules. So if anybody has listened to the podcast before, we've only got about a couple in so far, you'll know that I have three rules of this podcast that I really believe are the reason why I do it anyway. I don't want you to incriminate yourself because nobody wants anybody to get in trouble. We're here to do this to learn from one another. Don't incriminate others because we always believe in the world of DevOps and blamelessness and how we look at what happened. And then help us learn. So whatever the incident that kind of occurred, we want to know what did you learn from it and what can we learn from that. So let's get started. Do you have an interesting story from an on-call situation that really you can say it taught you, if not a lot, it taught you something that you just needed to know?
Yes, I do. And it's like this story probably is like the perfect storm of like security and ops.
Okay.
So basically, I was doing on call and this was over a weekend. We got a call that, and this is around the time to set some background on this. This was around the time where, I think people were just starting to realize how, or cloud providers. So this is an interesting cloud story. So this is a cloud nightmare, perfect storm story. And it starts off with me being on call and us getting a notice that due to a security vulnerability, an entire fleet of cloud services has to reboot.
This sounds super familiar, and I think a lot of us are going to know deep in our hearts what security vulnerability is. And we don't have to say which it is, but I will say that deep in our hearts, we are bleeding with some sort of interest with which specific one is, but I think I got a hint. Go for it.
Yeah. So because of this, pretty much their entire fleet, and when I say entire fleet, I mean worldwide, has to be rebooted. And so, of course, like we start the incident response process and pretty much it's kind of all hands on deck. But there is an extra complication. So our one of our back-end services, because we had, I believe it was Cassandra at the time, or the open source version of it, and it was either I forget whether it was the open source or the enterprise version, but we had a specific version that had a specific bug where in any other case, like if we didn't have this bug, it would be fine. But because we had this bug, if the system got rebooted, this instance or this Cassandra node would come back up corrupted.
The
actual data would come back up corrupted. So this meant that we had to physically take every cluster we had down, depending on the regional location, offline in order to preserve the data and not have like a complete outage like forever and long recovery times. So pretty much throughout the whole entire weekend, it is me kind of sitting and basically taking services down, and making sure the services are offline waiting for our virtual like nodes to get rebooted. And then once they are rebooted and we're assured that everything's safe, bringing them back online and making sure systems are okay.
So one by one, essentially rebooting it and then watching it and then saying,
yeah,
all right, pat you on the head. You're doing great. Go on.
Yeah, go about your business. Great. Go ahead. But that is just like the most nerve wracking thing, because it's like, we only have a specific time window, pretty much having to reboot and watch all systems and make sure that they come online perfectly. Just was a lot. And it was also that I got a whole lot less sleep from this. Because when you're in charge of multiple clusters and making sure that they come back online okay and that they're still usable, it can be really nerve-wracking, especially since they gave us a time frame when the reboots would happen, but we didn't get exact time frames.
Yeah, it's just so a it's control like, frame.
Yeah, so just a two-hour window of being like, here's when this is going to happen. And so for the, like, for
like the window. Like getting a cable installed, I get you.
Yeah, so like it was definitely an experience, a definite cloud experience or a perfect storm that I just, it was just a lot. And I learned a lot from that, because I learned how, despite everything going wrong, how things can go well and go smoothly despite that, because we had, you know, because we had so many people working on hand to make sure that after we brought the systems back up that they worked properly. And I kind of had backup and support from the rest of the infrastructure team, and just kind of the visibility, which kind of made me feel like it's one of those hero moments that I kind of took in stride, but also one of those teamwork moments that I super appreciated. But at the same time, the learning points of it were kind of a lot, along with like learning how a team works and learning how to respond to an incident, especially one that comes unexpectedly.
It's just not the technical aspects of on call that you're taking in. It's the procedural. So what kind of procedural stuff do you think that you really took from this kind of situation that made it so that, you know, all of these nodes that you had to be responsible for were all visible and back online?
And not only that, but being able to communicate to the executive team, being like, okay, here's what's going on. Here's our current status. And here's like where we're at. I learned this, and I think I truly value this back then, and especially right now, with security, with learning this from security too, that spreadsheets are very, very useful.
They can be.
Yeah. And so we used a lot of that to kind of keep track of like how to, you know, when systems were being rebooted and have they been rebooted yet. So like, not only could we keep track, but we could show a way to be visible. The entire process was kind of documented that way. Like, you know, I think we could support other teams that were reaching out to our customer base and being like, okay, here's the estimated time of the outage. Here's what we're going to do to fix this, you know, cause like post a real big outage like that. You know, you got to make sure that the customers are happy.
Absolutely.
So to be able to have that transparency, or be able to give that transparency and picture if needed, was super useful. And like, I think it showed me that people that, documentation sometimes, especially with incidents, goes underappreciated.
Oh, absolutely.
And so by having the data and things documented while the incident is happening, if you can possibly do it, is super useful.
So if you had to really take a lesson learned from, you know, this particular heart-aching kind of incident where you had to sit and pour over, which could have been, I'm not sure how many nodes, but certainly a lot of nodes. And you had to sit there and pour over all these nodes and watch them potentially go up and down. What did you gain from this particular incident where you just really weren't sure what was going to happen? Like, it's like, how did you learn from a situation where there's no real way to be able to tell whether this particular node is going to come up or down? You're taking a guess. What did you personally learn from that situation?
Pretty much what I learned from that situation is that you should always build for resiliency, especially if you're building in cloud environments.
That's a great piece of advice.
Like, especially if you're going into the cloud, I think nowadays it's easier to build in that sort of resiliency, especially, you know, with RDS becoming a thing, and more people doing, you know, backends as a service. But like that's one. And then the number two thing, which people always tend to put off, including myself sometimes, is make sure you patch your stuff. Make sure you keep it up to date. Like, there's only because, you know, if you don't, you may find yourself in an unexpected situation that you never intended. That it could be far worse than if, you know, you could have patched something. And I think had we, we kind of assessed the risk. I think back then it was like, it was probably would have been more costly, I think, at the time to
go through all those reboots.
Yeah, to go through all those reboots. But basically after that incident, it was like, well, we can't afford another one. Like, so let's start to see if we can, you know, patch these services one by one. But like having a consistent like way to patch things, I think is super critical, or just building a way to have some type of redundancy in case of worst case scenario.
So be prepared for the worst by preparing for the worst. You know, build redundancy into your systems. Don't make the assumption that things are just going to fall over. Also, be sure that you test that resiliency and that redundancy.
Oh, yeah. No, that is one thing. Like, and I know earlier startups can't do it, but it's like at some point in the first, like, 2 to 4 years, I'd say, if you can do it, you should start thinking about what is your disaster recovery plan.
And that's the scariest question to be asked by many, many, many at many companies. Because I've walked into rooms, and I'm sure maybe you have too, and I've asked somebody, so, you know, what happens if the database breaks in this region? What do you do? And a lot of times people don't have answers. Yeah. And that's because when the worst happens, we just kind of assume that systems that we have in place will protect us. Like, oh, well, we've got this failover that's going to protect us in these case, in their incident. But having testing done to ensure that your DR actually works, I think is far more important than just saying, hey, we've got a hot spare VPC set up in another region. And if something fails, we know we can move DNS over to that. That's not enough.
Well, that and things, especially in security, the thing about security is that things can break in so many unexpected ways that you would not believe.
Like a TLS protocol being deprecated and all of a sudden something stops working. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like I had one fun story where basically we implemented there were some firewall rules implemented, and it ended up basically filling up logs because the firewall configurations were improperly placed, so that the logging filled up the disk and services started going down. Like, how do you take in consideration of that, like, of that change?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you wouldn't,
The thing that I've always found terrifying about security is the number of dominoes that can fall. Patching, like you mentioned before, there's so many dominoes that can fall in the process of setting up a patch and then rebooting a system that if the patch requires it and not being sure what's going to happen after that patch is installed, even if you've tested it on other systems.
And that's also because of the other thing is like a whole lot of people also have staging systems that pretty much they either have automated testing on or testing that's not quite production, so mm-hmm. that when you hit production, people can do different things with it. Like, humans are not, like, in some ways can be very varietal in their habits, in their usage. So mm-hmm. you never know if, like, one specific thing will all of a sudden, like, make things fall apart. But
sure,
by testing and also, like, having things in place to be like, oh, we found something, or there's a bug, or there's a vulnerability, how are we responding to it? It makes things a whole lot less stressful.
It's actually having procedures when you find those incidents is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Or just a plan of action. Even if you don't have a solid policy, being like, okay, so we found this, what are we going to do? What are the steps that we're going to take to get this resolved? Or, like, sure, or I mean, at least who should we talk to?
Yeah, it's like, it's one thing to file a JIRA internally, but what's the escalation once the ticket's filed? What's the process to ensure that this particular incident doesn't continue to cause, like, a service level impact so that someone's not actually able to either access a service or a website or whatever it is that people are interested in accessing? I think reliability is obviously something that we're trying to build into everything we do. And I think the more we're getting further into the need to ensure that deployments are automated, the more that we're building reliability into the process of automating the services, you know, using tools to test reliability along the during the path to production, if you will. I think that's mm-hmm. been kind of important.
Yeah, that is definitely important. And some people really don't assume that reliability is actually security. Like, that's like the number one thing about security. Like, I actually remember one of the first talks I gave, I went over the little triangle, and one of the parts of the triangle is for security is accessibility. And accessibility relies heavily on your service being reliably, you know, active and there and, you know, accessible for people to use. So, like, if it's not there, then, like, you're kind of failing on that one part. So, like, it's definitely important.
Gotcha. So, Jam, thank you so much for giving me some time to talk with you about on-call security, all these things. And I'm curious, is there any projects or anything that you're working on right now that you want to tell our listeners about?
Currently not, though I may have some stuff coming down the pipeline.
Cool. Well, if you want to get in touch with Jamisha, you can. It's jamfish728. That is JAMFISH, FISH, not PH, because no jam bands. That's a strict rule for this podcast. Anyway,
yeah.
So thank you so much, Jam. I really enjoy talking to you when we get a chance. I know sometimes we get to chat on Twitter and things like that, and you're like a really wonderful person that I think has a great kind of insight into what people are doing in this industry. And there are some subjects that I'd love to talk with you a little bit more in the future about your experience of being, you know, queer and black in technology, but I don't know if I'm ready to do that on this podcast. There's going to be another more culture-y podcast I'm thinking about in the future. But the thing is that people like yourself have definitely introduced me to some of these subjects that aren't always easy to bring up. So I always wanted to say thank you for helping me learn a lot about people aside from just me and my own little world. So thank you always. You've been a great kind of person to bounce back and forth, even small ideas that I've had in the past. So so you can find Jamisha at, once again, Jamfish728, and look out for Jam Plays. Jam Plays is a fun thing that Jamisha does here and there. Jam listens to some music, talks about what they think about it, and I get a kick out of it because I'm a music nerd myself. So thank you so much, Jam. We will talk again very, very soon. And everyone, stay tuned. We're going to wrap up the podcast, and we'll be right back. Thank you. Well, thanks again for listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast. And this time we had Jam Fisher of Splice on. And if you'd like to get in touch with Jamisha, you can do so by sending them a tweet on Twitter. That is JAMFISH, F-I-S-H, 728, JAMFISH 728. Thanks again, Jam. I really appreciated having some time with you today. So make sure you keep on listening. We're going to have some great interviews coming up. Thanks a lot, and if you'd like to be in touch with me and be a part of the podcast, of course, you can just email me. It is oncallnightmares@gmail.com, or find us on Twitter, oncallnightmare. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.